Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's afternoon satsang. And before we do anything else, a very, very happy and holy Deepavali to all of you. We offer our most loving pranams to Swami on this most auspicious day and pray that His love enlightens each one of our lives. It enlightens each step that we take in every endeavor of ours. Before we speak a little about Deepavali, because it is not very often that we have a beautiful Thursday coinciding with such a beautiful festival, let me invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind, and a happy Deepavali to you too.
Sairam Prem, wishing you the same, and wish all our listeners also a very holy, happy, bright, cheerful, love-filled, light-filled Deepavali, because that is what this festival is all about, the festival of lights. You know, because it is Deepavali, as is the beautiful habit that has been inculcated in us by Swami, for everything we try to look at the significance, the meaning that it has in our present day context. And when we look at Deepavali in that way also, it brings to light some very beautiful knowledge, profound wisdom. And once again, these are from various discourses of Bhagwan. The festival of Deepavali is celebrated because it marks the annihilation of Narakasura. And a little research into Narakasura reveals that Narakasura was a demon born from the parents Bhudevi and Hiranyaksha.
Right.
So during our Vahini, Bhagavata Vahini satsang, we had discussed how the Varaha avatar came to rescue Mother Earth from the clutches of Hiranyaksha, the demon. So Hiranyaksha, the demon, troubled, molested and tortured Mother Earth, and a result of that contact between Hiranyaksha and Mother Earth was the demon called Narakasura. So there are some very positive things about Narakasura, and possibly that is the genetic material from Bhudevi, and there are some really vile and terrible qualities of Narakasura, the genetic material from Hiranyaksha. It looks like that. So Narakasura apparently was not called an asura in the beginning. He was, I don't know what was his name, but he was not an asura. And Wikipedia writes of his name as only Naraka. So apparently he got into bad company, the company of another demon called Banasura. And Banasura also has an interesting story. He's a demon with 1,000 arms, and he had got the protection of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva had told him that he would be there to protect him always, after which his ego went on a rise and he tried to destroy everything. And when he came to destroy Aniruddha, the grandson or great-grandson of Lord Krishna.
Grandson.
That is when he had to meet Lord Krishna in battle. And because of Lord Shiva's promise, Lord Shiva comes to, support him. And there's a battle between the two lords, Lord Shiva and Lord Vishnu. But it is said that Lord Shiva is made to sleep throughout the war by Lord Vishnu, during which the 1,000 arms of Banasura is cut off, his ego is humbled, and in fact Banasura seeks pardon from Krishna. That's all in the latter part of the story. But Banasura was a wicked demon possessed by ego. In fact, if we look at all the demons, all the asuras in our Puranas, all of them have these Arshad Vargas, that is Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madha, Matsarya, as their constant companions. And that is why it is said that this is bad company. Any person who harbors these traits is bad company. And that's what happened. Narakasura becomes bad, they say, because of the company of Banasura. And in fact, when I was going through the 2002 Deepavali discourse, the entire theme there, Swami stresses on the importance of satsanga as one of the important lessons from Deepavali. Because though he doesn't say about the friendship between Narakasura and Banasura. In fact, after coming in contact with Banasura, Naraka became Narakasura. He became the demon.
Okay.
Though Swami does not explicitly state it, it is implicit in his discourse. Because all the while Swami is emphasizing on the importance of good company for all the students. And in fact, Swami quotes this very same shloka with which we began our segment. The beautiful one which says satsangatve nisangatvam, nisangatve nirmohatvam, nirmohatve nischalatatvam, nischalatatve jivan mukti. In order to attain the ultimate, the beginning of the journey is with satsanga. And that is a beautiful coincidence. because on this Deepavali day, we are discussing this in afternoon satsang, and one of the most important takeaways from Deepavali, Bhagwan's discourse, is about satsanga.
And, you know, the beauty of this story of Narakasura is, I think, the one of the boons that he gets. You know, all of these asuras are known to ask for boons, which would, to an extent, guarantee immortality to them. You know,
in their opinion.
Right, and that's what we were speaking about in the earlier Bhagavad Vaini satsangs also. And Narakasura apparently asks for the boon that he can be killed only by his mother, with the belief that, you know, no mother would come forward to annihilate her own son. And that is how, you know, Bhuma Devi takes birth as Satyabhama, and Krishna, along with Satyabhama, encounters Narakasura, and it is Satyabhama who actually vanquishes Narakasura in the end. And, you know, the beauty is, Swami speaks of this episode and speaks of the inner significance of this. You know, you mentioned that Bhuma Devi is actually Satyabhama, and Bhuma Devi actually represents Prakriti. And Swami says, every one of us, you know, as human beings, we are actually represented by that Prakriti or Satyabhama. Hmm. And Swami says that Narakasura is nothing but, as you rightly pointed out, the six enemies which make Nara into an Asura. That's what Swami says. That when these six enemies become predominant in a human being, a normal human being, who is the Sanskrit word for that is Nara, becomes a Narakasura. So Swami says, now Satyabhama, who is nothing but the individual Jiva, the Jivatma, with Krishna, who is the Paramatma, together will have to battle the inner enemies, but the final vanquishment will happen only at the hands of each one of us. God will only be a support, God will only be a guide and help you to achieve it, but the end has to be brought only by one's individual effort. Swami says that is what is the significance of Deepavali, where you take the guidance of the Lord, but achieve the victory on your own.
It is so beautiful because even when you go by the Puranic story, it so happens that Krishna and Narakasura are matched in battle. So, as you said, ultimately it is Bhuma Devi Satyabhama who kills Narakasura. But before that, Satyabhama is simply sitting behind Lord Krishna and Garuda and watching this battle. And this battle goes on ravaging, you know, and they are matching each other's strength to strength. Finally, it is said that Narakasura takes a Shakti mace, a mace charged with some potent energy, and hurls it at Krishna. Mm-hmm. And apparently Krishna doesn't see this weapon coming. It hits him in the chest and he falls unconscious. Now, in an instant, seeing her Lord, seeing the life of her life, you know, this is the love of her life, the life of her love, everything this is for Satyabhama. When she sees this, she's unable to bear it, and it's an instinct. She just picks up that mace and hurls it back at Narakasura. It is said that the pain and anguish and that comes in her because she is separated from the Lord. You know, she is separated from the Lord, and that pain and anguish, she is unable to bear it. That pain and anguish gives rise to tremendous strength in her. And that makes her pick up the mace and throw it at Narakasura. And that is when Narakasura realizes that this is another form of Bhudevi. And that mace hits him in the chest, and that leads to the death of Narakasura. In fact, the story goes on that when Satyabhama realizes that in a way Narakasura is her own child, she comes and weeps for him. But Narakasura says that he is blessed to have been annihilated by her. And when we see this whole thing, metaphorically it suggests such a powerful thing. See, we grow these qualities of Kama Krodha, we nurture them on our own, almost like our children. We do that. We seem to be very hesitant to annihilate them. And that is possibly the reason why the Lord comes into our life and shows us that this thing that you are fostering as your child, which you think is dear to you, will be the one that will separate you from the one that is dearest to you. And that is why, you know, the first step, I feel, in removing the Arshadvargas is, rather than battling them, is to develop bhakti towards the Lord. See, that is what was suggested to Shuka, that is what was suggested by Shuka also to Parikshit, to redeem his life. That's why bhakti is such a beautiful thing, because once we get bhakti for the Lord, once we get bhakti, that is love for the Lord, Lord becomes the most important, God becomes most important, anything that takes us away from God becomes our enemy, even if it's our own child. That is what happened to Satyabhama. Even though Narakasura was like her own son, she didn't ponder even a moment before hurling that. And she hurled it with all her strength, simply because it had taken away her lord. Of course, once the mace hits and he is on his deathbed, Krishna smiles and wakes up from his act. And he says, nothing can touch, what can touch the lord? But in order to fulfill the rules of the drama that he himself has made, he had to do this and act as if he's unconscious. And this is the amplification of the same message, which also comes metaphorically through the story.
I mean, it's such a beautiful and so potent with inner meanings. And precisely what we've seen Swami doing to all of us, right? The moment Swami starts avoiding you, the moment Swami starts not talking to you, when you, when the cold treatment starts, immediately that self-introspection for the same things, you know, the same, where am I falling? What is it that Swami wants and I'm not able to do it? What you would have not been able to do for a long time, you know, some of the bad habits in you, some of the bad approaches to life that you have in you, the moment this fear that, oh, Swami is moving away from you comes, that fear will give you the energy and power to battle all those inner enemies or inner flaws that you had in me. In fact, I, even as you were narrating this, I was recalling an incident which one of the old devotees was narrating, where, you know, he had a lot of problems in life. And then he told his wife that, I'm going to go and sit in Parthi until Swami speaks to me and gives me a solution. I'm not going to come back. So he comes here and, it, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks go by. He's supposed to be a devotee whom Swami always talks to, right? But he comes here and Swami doesn't even look at him. And close to, I think, 1.5 months pass. And he exhausts all the money that he has and he has to go back, right? So it comes to a point where he's not even able to eat 3 times a day or 2 times a day because he has exhausted all the money that he has. And he's sitting one day in the mandir and as usual Swami has come and completely avoided the side where he was sitting. So then he was saying that he was just thinking, is there anything that Swami had asked me to do that I have not done that I should try to do it now so that I can get Swami's attention? Right, so he was like sitting there and ruminating, is there anything, is there anything? Then he recalled a very random thing which Swami would playfully tell. You know, he was a married man with children and all that. So Swami told him that, you know, celibacy is not something which has to be practiced only before marriage. Even after marriage, after a certain point, you should become a celibate. You should not always indulge in married life till you become old. Right? And Swami used to say this kind of playfully and making fun of him. And he also used to laugh it off. So, you know, sitting there, he thought to himself, this is something which Swami used to always tell me. So he looked at Swami who was walking away from him and he said, fine Swami, from today I will take a life of celibate. I will take a life of a celibate even though I am married. The moment he made that mental resolve, he saw that Swami turned, walked towards him and came and asked him, hey Bangaru, when did you come? I have not seen you for a long time. Like literally, you know, when that fear of losing Swami or when that anguish of Swami separating from you comes, that can give you that power to really battle something which you think is more powerful than you. You know, that's precisely what would have happened with Satyabhama. Here is a asura, and the asura whom even the gods fear, and you know, the godhead has to come and battle him. There is no way she is going to look at him and say that I have the power to destroy you. But this one feeling that my lord is being, you know, being taken away from me, gave her all the power to destroy that, you know, flaw which, I mean, that enemy was in front of her.
What a beautiful episode that was to highlight this principle of how we can use God as our strength and even separation from God as our strength.
Right.
Narakasura is dying now, and even as he's dying comes remorse, comes repentance, and he wishes to surrender himself to God. This is a beautiful thing, because we will see this thing getting highlighted even as Shuka narrates to Parikshit how God's grace doesn't need time. It's not like I've got only 2 days left, I've got only 1 day left. No problem, even a moment is enough, because as Swami would say in many of his discourses, a room that has been dark for a long time, say for 100 years, doesn't need 100 years to become bright. All it needs is one moment. You have to locate the switch, and the moment the switch is pressed, the whole room, however big it may be, is filled with light. Instantly. It doesn't mean that it has been dark for 100 years, so it'll take 100 years for it to light up. In the same manner, once that true light of wisdom dawns, the transformation is instantaneous. And that is what happens to Narakasura as well. And he says, Lord, I have spent all my life in ignorance. And it is through death, through this death that I am getting wisdom. I am so glad. I have only one wish. Let this day be remembered as a day when people move from darkness to light. That is possibly what has led to this tradition of bursting firecrackers on this day. Because in the night when everything is dark, you light it up with light. Though that is just the symbolic thing, the actual meaning is this is the day when we have to move from our ignorance to the light of wisdom that is showered on us by our Lord, by our dear Swami.
Right, and that is the idea of light itself, you know, it's so symbolic. Because light, as we know, it represents happiness, it represents warmth, it also represents wisdom, because we always associate light with knowledge. And that's a beautiful analogy which Swami would often say, that, you know, when there is darkness for hundreds and hundreds of years in a dark room, it doesn't take 100 more years to make it bright. It just takes that one moment. And in fact, that is something which Shuka Maharishi is going to allude to in the course of our, satsang today. Before that, another episode which is associated with Deepavali, maybe we'll recall that, because again, it is very significantly related to what we're going to speak today, because it's about another great devotee whom we all aspire to become, right? Goddess Lakshmi. And she is always described as that devotee who has this constant servitude of the Lord. Because when we speak of Padasevanam. We give her as the example. And, the festival with which this festival season begins is referred to as Dhanteras, or the festival of Lakshmi, the day on which we worship Mother Goddess Lakshmi. And again, we spoke about the different avatars of Lord Vishnu, the second of that being Kurma avatar, right? That avatar which was taken for aiding in the process of the churning of the ocean. And when the churning of the ocean happens, as we were speaking at that time, many, many objects and many, many things come out. Some are pleasant, some are unpleasant. The most unpleasant, of course, is the halahala poison. But many pleasant things come, and that again is a very beautiful message in itself, where they're all churning for this essence of immortality, the amrutam which is going to come out. But there is a lot of temptations which comes before that, in the form of, the airavat comes, and I think
There's a horse that comes.
Kamadenu, I think, comes.
Cow, yes.
And one of the people who emerge from that is actually Goddess Lakshmi. And after she comes, she's a person, she's not an object like the other things which come out. She comes out and she has this burning yearning to become a servant of the Lord, right? And Dhanteras is supposed to be the day on which she was accepted by Lord Vishnu. So it is actually a day when you worship a goddess, the idea is to please the goddess and get boons from the goddess. And when you want to please Goddess Lakshmi, you obviously want wealth. So when is goddess the most happy? Goddess is most happy when in the company of the Lord, right? That is the meaning of this whole festival. The festival of Lakshmi is celebrated because she is happiest when she has won this opportunity to be in the service of the Lord. And I think that again is a very, very beautiful message for all of us, that when you use your wealth in the service of the Lord, that is when Lakshmi will be most happy, and that is when actually she is going to bless you with more and more of her wealth.
And you know, another thing that I constantly like to keep repeating, I love this analogy, example, is that we often do Lakshmi Puja because we want Lakshmi, we want wealth. But we do not realize what is Lakshmi's own desire. Lakshmi's own desire was she had the most powerful asuras on one side, and the most powerful devas on the one side, you know. The best of all the beings were there when the churning was going on, and yet she said, I choose only Vishnu. She chose only Vishnu. So she was not one to get deviated by either the devas or the asuras or the ganas or whoever. Nobody could deviate her. Her one-pointed attention and focus is the Lord Vishnu. How foolish are we to think that she will let go of her position at the feet of the Lord and come to our homes because we are offering two coconuts to her or a few agarbattis or a few flowers. Can we bribe Mother Goddess Lakshmi with these little trivial things? That is why, you know, Swami often used to exhort that one must always do Narayana Seva. He would call he would never call it poor feeding. In fact, I remember in a discourse, Swami was mentioning, You do that feeding of the people once in a while and that also you do it poorly? Don't do poor feeding. Do Narayan Seva. Treat every being you meet as the Lord, and whether it is feeding them, clothing them, helping them, whatever, think that you are helping the Lord. That is true Narayan Seva. That is how Swami would say. Swami would say, what would you do if Swami was there in that position? How would you help Swami? Like that you do. That is Narayan Seva. And if we do Narayan Seva, that is, if we invite Narayana to our home, then automatically Lakshmi comes, right? I would like to call this as the buy one, get one free offer. You get Narayana, automatically Lakshmi comes home. But instead of that, we keep focusing on Lakshmi. However, even when we invite Narayana, there is one disclaimer. When we invite Narayana, we have to wholeheartedly invite Narayana for Narayana's sake, because we love the Lord. We should not invite Narayana keeping an eye out on Lakshmi, thinking of the Lord as a means to the end. Let not the Lord be a way for us to get wealth. Instead, let our wealth and influence, prosperity, Lakshmi, Vibhuti, be a way for us to get our Lord.
And the beautiful thing is, you know, as they say in Bhagavatam, if you read, most of the devotees of Lord Narayana were actually poor. Most of them will be materially spoken of poor. I think that is the test which the Lord gives, you know, because you need Lakshmi the most when you are poor. Even then, when you are you able to change your focus from Lakshmi and look at the Lord and seek only Him? And I think that's when you get the true wealth, the wealth which Lakshmi thought if she has, she will be rich. I think that is the wealth you will get when you turn to the Lord. And I think that is the very essence of Bhagavatam. But today is this beautiful festival of Deepavali, so I think this song we must hear at least once every Deepavali, right? It's the beautiful song which was part of the movie which Swami had blessed, Shirdi Ke Sai Baba, where there's a beautiful Deepavali song. Almost every Deepavali when we had the opportunity, we used to sing this in front of Swami, in Swami's presence.
And you know, Prem, before you play the song, if we have seen the movie, if those of us who have seen the movie will realize that that song presents exactly the same thing about what is the true meaning of Lakshmi. Because here is this girl, if I'm not mistaken, her name is also Lakshmi. She comes only in name, she's Lakshmi. She's very poor. So poor that she's unable to afford oil and wick during Deepavali to light lamps at her home. So she goes to some of the traders and shopkeepers and requests them to lend a little oil, give her a little oil and wick, and everybody shoos her away. She goes crying to Shirdi Baba and says that, Lord, I couldn't get any wick and oil. And she says, I didn't want them for lighting them at home. I wanted them to light them up here at this dilapidated, means what is that dilapidated mosque, you know, which Shirdi Baba would call as Dwarka Mai, Mother Dwarka. She says, I wanted to light it here, I couldn't get it. And when she cries, it is so beautifully pictured in the movie, when she cries, a teardrop falls into a pot of water that is by Shirdi Baba's side. When that teardrop falls, that is a teardrop of true love that she has towards Shirdi Baba. Baba says, child, why do you worry? We have sufficient oil here. And he takes the water, pours it into pots, puts the wick and lights them, and a miracle happens there. You know, there is light, there is love, there is laughter, because it is that girl who laughs and smiles and in thrill of joy of having known Narayana, whom having known him, Lakshmi is automatically there, whether the world decides to confer it or not. It is in that joy and exuberance she sings that song. And here that song is not in a female voice, I'm sure, but let us also participate in that song, in that same exuberance, joy that comes out of our devotion to our dear Swami.
मनाए सुहानी मेरे बाबा के हाथों में जादू का पानी दीपावली मनाए सुहानी दीपावली मनाए सुहानी मेरे साई के हाथों में जादू का पानी दीपावली Shut श्रद्धा का दीपक भक्ति की ज्योति, श्रद्धा का दीपक भक्ति की ज्योति, सत्य प्रेम की जलती निशानी, सत्य प्रेम की जलती निशानी, दीपावली मनाई सुहानी, दीपावली मनाई सुहानी, मेरे साई के हाथों में जादू का पानी, दीपावली मेरे साई की अमृतवाणी, मेरे साई की अमृतवाणी, मैं तो भैर साई दीवानी, मैं तो भैर साई दीवानी, ओ द्वारिका मैया ये भेद पुरानी, द्वारिका मैया ये भेद पुरानी, दीपावली मनाए सुहानी, दीपावली मनाए सुहानी, मेरे बाबा के हाथों में जादू का पानी, दीपावली मनाए सुहानी, मेरे साई के हाथों में जादू का पानी, दीपावली दीपावली दीपावली।
Welcome back, dear listeners, on this beautiful occasion of Deepavali. After that little discussion on Deepavali, we'll get back to our subject proper, which is the Bhagavata Vahini. Of course, even our previous discussion was an extension of the Bhagavata Vahini itself, for it was filled with Krishna, it was filled with our Lord Sai, it was filled with love for God. So, in that sense, we have not had any digression. We were at that point in our narration where Raja Parikshit, the Emperor Parikshit, has given up his kingdom and is sitting in front of Shuka, and Shuka is about to narrate the Bhagavatam. Before we proceed, Prem, you know, I received a mail from one of our avid listeners who pointed out saying that, you know, Mother Gandhari curses Krishna that after 36 years of rule, mm-hmm, you and your entire clan will get destroyed. So, she says if that is a point in time when, you know, Parikshit was supposed to have been born, then this listener was saying that Parikshit should have been a 36-year-old person when Krishna passes away and the Pandavas set out. But apparently, one of us mentioned that Parikshit was a 14-year-old boy. So, mm-hmm, what is this age problem? So, I started researching this and I found out that nowhere in the Bhagavata Vahini has Swami mentioned Parikshit as a 14-year-old boy during the coronation. Okay. It must be one of us who mentioned it, because Swami describes a little boy there. And I was thinking, why is it like that? Because in all other sense, Parikshit should have been 35-year-old. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that the Pandavas, when they set out on their Mahaprasthan, Yudhishthira was something like 137-year-old, 140-year-old, I don't know, Yudhishthira or Arjuna, but they were well into their 140s, 150s. That was the age of the Pandavas, which means the lifespan those days was nearly 80% more than these days. And therefore, in a reply to the listener, I would just like to say that what is considered as 18 and 19-year-old, 14-year-old today, possibly in those days, the 30-year-old was like that, you know. I just feel like that. And that is the reason why it is said that at a very young age, Swami writes in the Bhagavata Vahini of Parikshit being a person of a very young age. And it is definitely a young age considering the fact that people live up to 150, 160. And when the Pandavas left, they didn't leave as old people, you know. Because a few years before that only we saw how Dhritarashtra and Vidura left. Yeah. Which means it must have been the norm to live up to maybe 200 years, 220 years. So in a 220-year lifespan, 36 can be considered as the teenage years. And that is possibly the reason why we also happened to mention him possibly as a 14-year-old. But I must thank the listener for this, because in my mind it was like Parikshit is in his teens. But when we look at the research, when we look at all the texts also, Parikshit was about 36-year-old when he took over the reins of the kingdom. He ruled for about 24 years, and when he was 60 is when all this happened, and he gives up. So from our Kali Yuga perspective, he lived a full life, but he was very young in age from that Dwapar Yuga perspective, when people lived up to 200, 220 years. I just thought I'll make this one clarification discovery. I might be wrong, because there are some assumptions that I have made here, but this is the explanation.
And hopefully people don't think that all right, then 60 is the age you have to start listening to the, Bhagavatam.
Yes, 60 is the age in case you're going to live up to 220.
Right, if you're sure that you're going to live for 120 years. But, going back to the Bhagavatam and this scene, which Swami, in fact, if you look at it, the whole Bhagavatam is supposed to be this dialogue between this Maharishi, Shuka Maharishi and Parikshit. But if you look at the content-wise, I think we are probably in the third quarter of the book or the fourth quarter of the Bhagavat Vaini, and the conversation has still not begun. And I think that again is a very important message that Swami is giving, that the content which you hear in the name of Swami, stories may be different. Like for us, for all of us, Bhagavatam is not necessarily the story of the 9 or 10 avatars. For us, Bhagavatam is the story of Swami. So that content might change and might be different for different people. Somebody might be listening to only stories about Rama, somebody might be listening only stories about Krishna. So the content part actually changes. What is more important is that setting of how that transfer of wisdom has to take place, how the recipient has to be, and what sort of a person has the authority to give that wisdom. Swami is giving so much emphasis on that, and he is constantly describing how a person should listen, how a person should be eager to receive that knowledge, and then, glorifying Sukha Maharishi as not somebody who is, carried away by emotions. He's not a person who is going to sit there and talk of the story like he's a, script writer of a movie. It's not that kind of a person. He's a person who is completely detached, right? And he is telling the story with such passion. And when he is asked, what is that one remedy which you can give us for sanctifying life, he's saying this. And in fact, Swami starts, the part which we're going to start today, starts with Sukha Maharishi saying how the Bhagavatam is literally no less than the Vedas themselves. And if you look at it, the Vedas are considered to be Shruti, right? And the Bhagavatam is supposed to be written or compiled by Vedavyasa. In that sense, it's a Smriti. It is created by man. But in spite of it being a creation of, a poetic creation of Vedavyasa, it is in no way lesser in comparison to the Vedas. That is what Sukha Maharishi tells Parikshit, that this is so very potent that it is comparable even to the Vedas.
And that is what even Bhagwan has told us, right? That in the Kali Yuga, thinking of the Lord and chanting His name is the greatest liberators available. In fact, going back to what you said about more than half the book being covered and still the dialogue has not begun, I feel it only emphasizes the importance of yearning and craving that a person must have. Because all through this time we have discussed how Parikshit, though he's a king, see, it's not like Parikshit is a free boy, a free person left to pursue anything. He has the responsibilities of the entire kingdom. And it is not as if Parikshit is pursuing the Lord only after he gave up the responsibilities of the kingdom. Even while he was pursuing and even while he was performing all his duties systematically and perfectly as a king, all the while in the background, there was this, like how we have a background music which goes on irrespective of whether there's a dialogue going on or not. Even in a movie, even at night when person is sleeping, there's a background music going on. In that manner, like a background music, the Lord Krishna and his love for Krishna was always there. That was the kind of yearning he had. That is such an inspiration for us in this day and age when we think that we don't have time. I would love to do this for Swami, but I don't have time. I would love to think about Swami, but I don't know when to fit it in my schedule. Are we more busy than the king who had to rule the entire kingdom? So that is where Parikshit becomes an inspiration, and I feel that is possibly the reason why Swami has delayed it till half the book also. In fact, just before this satsang started also, you know, we were speaking exactly this, saying, oh, when will it begin, man? Even now we are also beginning to wonder when will it begin, because we have covered half the book and the story has not yet begun. Because the story, as you said, is beautiful, no doubt, but it will be able to give us all the benefits that it is meant to only when we yearn and crave for it. And I feel that is one important thing that we should develop in ourselves. We will get to hear Swami stories also. Visit radiosci.org. There's everything there. But many times, you know, I have been stumped by people coming and telling me a story or an experience or an episode, and I ask them, where did you get this from? Because, you know, this will be nice to come on our site. And they tell me, don't, it's on your site. You don't know about it. You have not heard about it. Now, I must mention one neighbor of mine, an elderly uncle, who keeps telling me amazing things, and he tells, is there on your radio, sir? You didn't hear this? You didn't hear this? That is when I realize that I have not heard it at all. And I don't know who is more blessed, me being at Radio Sai or he being away from Radio Sai, but knowing everything that is there on Radio Sai. See, it is that yearning and craving that matters a lot, I feel. And that is what we should strive to develop. Because if one, that yearning and craving is there, as you said, any story of the Lord has that liberative effect. It is not as if you have to listen to only this story. And when we are on this theme, I would like to make use of this opportunity to slip in a quick advertisement also to our listeners, that, dear listeners, tomorrow onwards on our Radio Sai website, we will be beginning a continuation of a serial that we started 2 years back. The same hosts, your hosts Prem, Anush and myself, we will be doing the Satya Sai Katha, the Sai Katha, entitled as Satya to Sai, a video serial which you can catch on our homepage every Friday, every week, starting from tomorrow. There will be one episode, and of course, it will be archived perfectly on the Radio Sai YouTube channel as a separate playlist called Satya to Sai, Sai Katha 2, episode 13 onwards till episode 24. Episode 1 to episode 12 covered Swami's life from his birth till he declared himself as Sai Baba on the 20th of October. And that was aired 2 years back, concluding on the 20th of October. Now the second season, starting from episode 13, is from the 20th October till the establishment of the Patha Mandiram in 1945. And so again, matching with that episode, we will be starting this on the 20th of October, unlike the previous one which concluded on the 20th of October. So tomorrow is 20th of October. Dear listeners, do tune in and watch this serial, because it is the modern Bhagavatam, it is our Sai Bhagavatam, and when we have that yearning and pining for Swami, these are beautiful leelas, mahimas and stories of the Lord that is sure to liberate us.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, the urgency which Parikshit is showing, you know, apart from ending, we spoke about that when we doing the Bahutwaini satsang the last time, where when Shuka Maharishi was telling him stories about Swayambhu Manu and Satrupa, and he said, you know, I don't want to listen to the stories of other kings and, you know, how they started, how they were righteous. I don't want to listen to all of that. I want to listen to stories of Krishna, right? Because even among the many avatars that the Lord takes, the dearest to him was Krishna, because, you know, I'm sure he was eager to listen to stories of Krishna, in spite of, as you were saying, even as a king, he was always interested in and you know, steeped so much in devotion to Krishna. Same is the case with all of us. You know, yes, it's so nice to listen to Ramakatha Rasvahini. Yes, it's so nice to listen to Bhagavat Vahini. But, you know, eventually, as so many of you listeners have pointed out, even in these satsangs, what really makes you enjoy it is the few stories of Swami that we managed to slip in between the stories of Rama and Krishna. So if you enjoy that, then I think Satya to Sai would be as enjoyable to you, I mean, as it was to us when we brought it to you and when we recorded it, and we are so very excited to be able to show it to you from tomorrow.
You know, speaking of Swami stories, I think we will give one more Swami story to our listeners, because at this point in time, you know, Parikshit is actually getting a little desperate. He tells Shuka Maharshi that, I want to, you know, listen to Krishna stories. Please come to that. because I have got very little time left. And that is when, you know, Shuka Maharshi actually narrates to him the story of a certain Khatvanga. He says, I will narrate to you the story of a Rajarishi by name Khatvanga. And he narrates the story in order to tell Parikshit that when it comes to the Lord, even if you are not aware of what is going to happen, even if you are not aware of your impending death, and it is never, never too late to think of the Lord. You can achieve it. You know, and that is what Shuka reassures him and tells him the story of Khatvanga. And I was reminded, you know, of reading this episode. It's an episode that is narrated in the Satyam Shivam Sundaram.
Mm-hmm.
But I read it as written by another devotee. His name is Ra Ganapati. And in his book, Baba Satyasai, he writes. He writes saying that one need not be aware also of the Satyasai name and form in order to be blessed by him and saved by him. And he recounts an episode that happened at the Vashishta Gufa, a cave near Rishikesh. This cave exists to this day also, Prem. And it has become a sanctuary, another Sai center-like thing there with Swami's photographs, because Swami had visited this Vashishta Guha. And he had visited an elderly Swamiji there by the name Purushottamananda. And Swami had taken a picture with Swami Purushottamananda. Incidentally, this picture of Swami and Swami Purushottamananda had been stolen from the ashram.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years back, when a group of Swami students had been there, and when they got to know this, they came back here and picked up that photo from our Radio Sai archives, laminated it and presented it back to them. They were so thrilled at that ashram there. This is an episode that happened during that time, which the author writes to say that you need not even be aware. If you just have that inclination and goodness in you, the Lord will himself come. It is said that when Swami was there at the Vashishta Gufa, suddenly Swami goes into a trance. And when Swami goes into a trance, everyone knows that he is gone somewhere. Though his body is motionless, his palms come together and, you know, they are cupping over each other as if they are protecting something very precious. And when Swami comes out of the trance, they ask Swami what happened. Most of the time Swami never answers this question, and he brushes it off, laughs it off as if it's something minor. Because as far as the Lord is concerned, they're all minor, because for him the devotee is what matters the most. But on this occasion, for our whole benefit, for the benefit of the whole world, the Lord decided to narrate what happened. And Swami says, you don't know what has happened? Call that Subramanyam. That Subramanyam is there. So there was this person called Subramanyam on the entourage. Mm-hmm. And he's called. And Swami tells, tell everybody what you saw. And he says, Swami, what I saw is something ashubham, something that is not holy, something, and that's why I don't want to tell. Swami says, no, you tell them what it is. Swami, I saw the corpse of a sannyasi Sadhu. Or a saint or some sadhak, because he was dressed only with his loincloth, nothing else. I saw the corpse of this person being washed away in the Ganga. I didn't want to bring it to your notice because it's such a holy setting here. I didn't want to speak of a dead body. Then Swami laughs and says, that is not a corpse. That is a yogi. He is in trance. And when he's in that yogic trance, he's doing the pranayam, the breath control, because of which his body doesn't sink in the water. He had been meditating, but the river has grown in size and it has washed away his seat.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's lost in trance, he has not realized that, and he has got washed into the Ganges. And Swami said that he got carried down. He got carried along the river. He was floating because of his pranayama. But then, suddenly the water hitting on his body brought him back to his body. And at that time, fear engulfed him. And Swami said, when fear engulfs, even though you are a master of pranayama, that practice collapses. In fear, you can't do any spiritual practice. Because of which he began to sink. The moment he began to sink, I had to go. I protected his heart so that he doesn't drown. And Swami says, it took me some time because I was trying to locate a possible place where he will receive help. And I am forgetting the name. Swami also gives the name. Yes, Shivananda Nagar. Mm-hmm. Swami says, at Shivananda Nagar, I have dropped him off at a place where he'll receive biscuit, tea, coffee, and he'll get back his strength. And he's fine. Now I have come back. And when Swami says this, you know, they're all thrilled because that person doesn't even know that there is this Satya Sai avatar physically so close who has come to save him. But Swami also doesn't seem to have any inclination to let him know that I am God, your man, I have come and saved you. It doesn't matter. Because when there is love, it is a spontaneous expression from the Lord. The Lord seeks no reward. He seeks no attention. He seeks no kind of gratitude, nothing. He does it because love has no reason. Love has no season. That's all. And he is pure love. So, you know, I was just reminded of this beautiful episode that has been captured by the author Ra Ganapati. When I read this part where Shuka is about to narrate the story of Katvanga to Parikshit.
And for all that we know, he might be an Advaitin who does not even have that sort of devotion to any form. Forget, you know, to Swami.
Correct.
Being a yogi, he might be lost in a very advanced form of yogic practice. But I think that again is another conversation. I don't know whether we mentioned it, where Parikshit asks Sukumarishi that, you know, you speak so highly of Bhagavatam, but I'm fascinated and I'm curious to know, how did you get attracted to it? Because we spoke about Sukha's birth, where he does not come out of the mother's womb for so many years.
16 years,
because he does not want him to get into attachment. And even after he is born, he straight away walks into the forest to become a renunciant. He skips all the other ashramas of life. And so Parikshit is asking, means being such a person, being so detached, how did you get fascinated and attracted to the stories of the Lord? And that is when, you know, Sukumarishi tells Parikshit that how he heard the Bhagavatam for the first time. And I think he mentions that place called Gandhamadana.
Gandhamadana Mountain.
Gandhamadana,
yes.
Mountain. We had mentioned it, I think, earlier also. And apparently this is supposed to be a very special place filled with many, many significant events. One is, of course, they say that is a place where Lord Hanuman lives even till this day, because we know that he's a Chiranjeevi. Apart from that, it's the place where Parashurama meets Dattatreya after he vanquishes, you know, the 21 generations of
Kshatriyas.
That is where he goes and he atones for his sin, and Dattatreya gives him wisdom. So he says that that is the place where Sukumarishi listens to the Bhagavatam for the first time from Vedavyasa, and he says that even though I'm a person who is constantly established in that Nirguna Tattvam of Brahman, when I heard the Lord's stories, you know, he says I became restless with joy. I started becoming so jubilant, I couldn't control my emotions. And I was instantly attracted to that story, and I knew that, you know, this is one story listening to which anybody can attain the ultimate. And you know, that's what, going back to that yogi, the thin line between bhakti and jnana, you and I as sadhakas might not acknowledge it, but from the Lord's point of view, it's one and the same. And you know, that is what Sukumarishi is saying, that because the story is, it can give deliverance not only to the devotee, but it can give deliverance even to a yogi who does not believe in devotion or God as being a separate entity. And he said, that's why I was attracted to the story.
Hearing this explanation from Shuka as to how he, an absolute Sitapragni, one who is equanimous always, got so excited and thrilled and wanted to do this. I remember a discussion that we were once having as to how the state of Sitapragna can be. Sitapragna or equanimity is supposed to be a state where you neither have highs nor you have lows.
Right.
So while our lives is like a sinusoidal curve, you know, up, down, you know, a pleasure interval between two pains, that kind. A yogi's life appears to be like a flat line. You know, a flat line, straight. So that is how we concluded the discussion. I mean, that is how the discussion was about to get concluded, when suddenly somebody said, yes, agreed that a yogi's line is a flat line. But why do we think that that flat line should be in the center? I mean, if we have a X and Y axis, on Y above you have plus positive values and below we have negative values. And when we say a curve, a sinusoidal curve going from positive to the negative, negative to the positive, that is the ups and downs of life. And we think Sitapragna is a straight line at 0 point, where you neither have excitement nor you have, you know, sorrow, whatever. So somebody asked the question, yes, Sitapragna means absolute balance, no ups and downs. But why should that straight line be at zero? What if that straight line is actually at positive infinity? And that is how it is described, right? That is a state of infinite bliss. So if it is a state of infinite bliss, how can it be a straight line at, how can it be a straight static line at zero? It should be a straight line at infinity. And I thought, oh, you know, it was a point definitely worth pondering about. And listening to Shuka, it almost feels like Shuka saying, yes, I am detached, dispassionate. I was a straight line at zero. But the moment I heard Krishna's story, I continue to remain a straight line. But now the straight line is at positive infinity. And that's why I choose to be there. It almost feels like that. And that is why possibly, you know, even a jnani, as you said, from the level of the Lord, Advaita, jnana and bhakti are the same. And an Advaitin like Shuka also answers to Parikshit, telling the story of Khatvanga. But before we go into the story of Khatvanga, dear listeners, we'll take a little break. On the other side of the break, we'll continue with the story, which is really so beautiful and thrilling for us, especially in this Kali Yuga.
Sagar, prem ke sindhu
दीन बंधु दीननाथ भगवान अनुपम सुंदर प्रशांति वासा हृदयेश्वर साई राम हृदयेश्वर साई राम युगवतारा पावन
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were at the point where we were about to narrate a very, very beautiful story which Shikhar Maharishi narrates to Parikshit. And the context in which this story comes up is, as we said, Parikshit is becoming restless. And I was just telling Arvind, if he was here, he would become more restless because we are taking longer than Shukha to, you know, begin the story. Bhagavatam and, you know, the real Bhagavatam in that sense. Because Parikshit, you know, I think in the back of his mind, what is weighing him down is this idea that he's got only 7 days to live.
And we don't have that right. fear in our
heads. Exactly. And we have any number of more afternoon satsangs to do. So Parikshit looks at Shukha Maharishi and says, you know, let's get on with the story. You know, very politely he says, but that's the essence of what he says. Because he says, I have only 7 days. And in these 7 days, I need to listen to as much as the stories of the Lord as it is necessary to, you know, sublimate one's life. And to, in response to that question, Shukha Maharishi tells him that, you know, you don't have to worry about this because let me tell you the story of Katvanga because this will tell you how much time is necessary for one to sanctify one's life with the name of the Lord. And, he narrates the story of,
Rajarishi Katvanga.
Rajarishi. He's supposed to be a king, but also a rishi.
Yes. So he belonged to the Solar dynasty, like Lord Rama, right?
Right.
Yes, the Solar dynasty. So he is also part of the Solar dynasty, and he was such a powerful king that it is said that even when the war happened between the Asuras and the Devas took his assistance to defeat the demons and Rakshasas and the Daityas. And Katvanga helps them and defeats them, and all the Devas are beholden to him for his help. So they come to him and they tell him that you have been greatly helpful for us. We are so happy with what you have done. We don't know how to offer our gratitude to you. So you ask for whatever you want, we shall grant it to you. And Katvanga says that, listen, O gods, why do people do yagnas? People do yagnas to please you, right? And therefore, I did this whole thing in order to please you only. And since I did it to please you, this is also my yagna. So please consider this like an yagna. When somebody does a yagna, you don't go and feel gratitude towards him, right? So please, there is no need for you to feel grateful towards me. It is my honor, it's my pleasure, it's my privilege to do this. So when he tells this, the gods, they say that great. So whenever somebody does yagna, we are happy and we shower him with boons. So you let us know what do you want as a boon. We want to shower you because we are very happy. When they say like this, it's almost like Katvanga's hand is forced. So he says, okay, my lords, my god, before I ask for what I want, I would like to know how long I live, how long I'm going to live. So depending on how long I'm going to live, I will ask. I feel this is such a beautiful, practical way of asking, you know, because even when we are asked, what do we want, when we want to ask Swami, I think the whole thing will depend on how long we think we'll be living. If we feel that in 2 years, 2 years is all that I have to think about, okay, let me put it the other way. If we were to ask Swami what we want, it depends on what term view we are having. If we have a long term view, we'll be asking something else. If my view is only for the next 2 weeks, I may ask for something. If I'm thinking of the next 2 years, I may ask for something else. So depending on how long I'm thinking of, the thing that I ask will vary. And most probably, the greatest, wondrous and most beautiful things I will ask for only when my view is of a very long term. So therefore, Khatvanga very intelligently says, please let me know how long I'm going to live. Accordingly, I will ask for what I want. That is when he is told that you have got only one muhurtam to live. One muhurtam is
48 minutes.
48 minutes, yeah, less than an hour. And when Khatvanga comes to know that he has got one muhurtam to live, he says, no, I don't want anything else. I don't want anything. Because nothing matters now. Nothing matters. All the things of the world, glory, riches, influence, everything, mean nothing for me. And Khatvanga then sits in contemplation of the Lord and does Namasmarana. Thinking of the Lord, chanting the Lord's name, and becomes one with the Lord. And Shuka narrates that having done Namasmarana for just one muhurtam, Khatvanga attains Narayana. So you see, it is not the quantity of time that matters, but the quality of time spent. And therefore, Shuka Maharshi says, O Parikshit, don't worry. Don't worry, don't get that feeling of urgency saying you have only 7 hours, because Khatvanga had just one muhurtam. But as long as you do what is perfectly supposed to be done in that muhurtam, you will attain what you wish to attain.
And I think the secret lies in that, because what has to be done to get that in one muhurtam, or even lesser than that, is what Shuka Maharshi describes the state which Khatvanga was in. Because, you know, the moment he came to know that he is not going to live for more than 48 minutes, it was meaningless for him to attach himself to anything, be it the kingdom which he had fostered, be it his kith and kin, be it the victory that he had just attained. He said that, you know, when I'm going to live only for a year, I mean for a muhurtam, what is the point in saying that my people, my things, my glory and all of that? And Shuka Maharshi says that, you know, he lost that sense of mine and I. And that is what qualified him to attain the ultimate state even in such a short time. So he looks at Parikshit and says, I mean, probably we'll just read out those few lines. He says, O King, equip yourself with the sword of detachment. Cut into pieces the deluded affection for the body. Give up the minus that makes you cling to your kith and kin. Be seated firmly on the bank of this sacred river. He says, this is how, I mean, as we said, this is how you prepare yourself for listening to the name of the Lord. When you prepare yourself to listen to the stories of the Lord. And if you have prepared yourself this way, then I think in the later part he explains what will happen when you listen to stories of the Lord. But this is the preparation. And as we saw, actually Parikshit is prepared in this manner.
Perfectly. Right? No, that is what I thought we should emphasize. Because though it is presented like that, Khatvanga story, I am sure Khatvanga has a lifetime of practice, because to be able to apply that logic in such a cold manner, apparently cold manner,
right,
and detach yourself within one muhurtam, it's not easy. Because let us try it on our own lives. Forget giving up our parents or our near and dear ones. Even objects we can't give up like that. You know, I can't give up my motorbike like that. I mean, forget. Because I'll say, no, maybe I can give up a plastic glass that I have, but not my motorbike. Because I am still lost in the concept of value based on the worldly things, you know. So, in order to have the ability to detach yourself and completely focus on the Lord, you need a lifetime of preparation. And as you rightly said, this example of Khatvanga applies and holds true for Parikshit, because Parikshit is also prepared in that manner. For example, when we read through Parikshit's stories, we don't get to know what were the entertainment shows he was seeing in his kingdom. And even in that entertainment thing, we read of how he wants to know only the stories of Krishna. Through entertainment, through food, through whatever he does, he wants only Krishna. So, right, like we said in the beginning of the satsang, all the things of the world becomes means for him to reach Krishna rather than the other way around. And therefore, Parikshit is prepared. And so, while it is good to get inspired from the story of Khatvanga, we should realize that it requires almost a lifetime of effort, persevering effort for us to reach that state of readiness, wherein if Swami comes and tells, you know, all your karmas are done, dear one. Come, I'm ready to take you. I must be able to, yes, my Lord, and just drop everything and go. Go with Swami. I don't think many of us, most of us are ready in that manner.
Right. You know, a very famous interaction with the devotee, which people often refer to. I don't know who the devotee is. Apparently, an elderly lady would come to Swami and very often ask, Swami, give me moksha, give me moksha. And one instance in the interview room, Swami told her, okay, I'll give you moksha now. And she said, Swami, not now. I mean, my daughter's wedding is there or something like that.
Let me just inform my husband.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and that is what it is. And that's what we started off by in the beginning when we spoke about Deepavali, that, you know, when your attachment to the Lord becomes so strong that it makes dropping everything else so very effortless. You know, Katvankar could have might as well asked for a little longer lifetime. You know, even that could have been granted, because it's not ordinary people who are offering him a boon. It's not a rich man who's offering him a boon.
Mm.
It's the gods themselves. But, you know, he knew that it's an inevitability which will come, and this is actually a boon when you know how long you have to live. You know, just like even in Ramkatha Raswani, when we spoke about Vali, when he is given that offer by Rama that I will extend your life. You know, now that you have transformed, I'll extend your life. He says, no, don't do that. I know that I'm going to die, and I'm getting this opportunity to die in this glorious manner. Right? That is what Katvanga, you know, expressed. And that is exactly what Parikshit also expressed when he came to know about the curse which has come. And I think that is the readiness. If death no more scares you, if the idea of losing everything in your life no more scares you, but actually is going to make you elated about the idea of losing everything, I think probably you're in that state what Shuka Maharshi is describing, that be ready to cut all your attachment with the sword of detachment.
And so now the actual conversation begins, and Shuka has promised to narrate to Parikshit the different avatars of the Lord, because Bhagavatam, as later on, you know, it is described even in the Bhagavata Vahini, the Bhagavatam consists of three parts. One, the glories and wonders of Bhagavata, Bhagavan, of the Lord. The second, the devotion, the pining, the love and sacrifices of the Bhakta. And the third, the Bhakti itself, the devotion that binds the Bhakta with the Bhagavan. So, the Bhagavata is filled with stories of advent of the Lord. And when we say of advent of the Lord, the Dashavatar that we say, the Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narahari, Vamana, Narasimha, Vamana, Parshurama, Rama, Krishna, these avatars are special ones. But as I think we discussed in the previous satsang also, as narrated by Shuka and written by Bhagwan in the Bhagavata Vahini, the Lord keeps incarnating in multiple ways, in multiple forms, as a bird, as a tiger, as a snake, as a, you know, as every kind of thing, for different purposes. Some of them are for little time, some of them for long time. That's why there's this concept of the Purnavatar, where they say Krishna alone is a Purnavatar. And we shall not go into the details of the Purnavatar right now at this point in time. But there are so many Amshavatars, little avatars, that avatars, multiple kinds of avatars. In fact, when you read that, you almost feel as if you never know whether you are sitting in the studio of Radio Sai and I am sitting and not talking to Prem, but another avatar of the Lord. Because that is the feeling that Swami arouses when he writes, saying that treat every being, everything that you see around as an avatar, because for all that you know, it might actually be an avatar. So, Shuka starts off by saying that there are, everything is a manifestation, everything is an avatar of the Lord, but there are certain avatars that we will be focusing on. And when he tells that, the question that arises in Parikshit's mind is, why does the attributeless Parabrahman, the formless immanence transcendence, why does it assume form at all? Please tell me about this. That is the question that Parikshit asks.
Right, and I mean, that's the most logical question to ask. I mean, as we can see, before this, the question that he asks is, you know, how did you get attracted to it? Because, you know, someone whose mind is so fixated in the attributeless Brahman himself will not be interested in stories of, you know, excitement or battle of victories,
of emotions
and all of that. Then what about the Lord himself? The Lord who is attributeless, nirguna, and, you know, you talk of somebody who is absolute, who does not have any qualities at all. why does that Lord come in the form of a human being? And in many ways, actually, Swami has answered this question in the introductory chapter to Bhagavata Vahini, which we spoke of, where Swami spoke of the vow that Krishna takes in the battlefield when he's explaining this concept to Arjuna. But Sukha Maharshi decides to explain this through another little story which happens, which is the story or a little dialogue, a conversation between sage Narada and Lord Brahma, where Lord Brahma is actually the father of Narada. Narada is referred to as Manasaputra, or the child who is born out of the thought of Lord Brahma. Mm. And in that conversation, Lord Brahma explains the whole idea of creation. He says that, you know, everything has come from my creation, my will. My will has created everything. And there is an order in creation which has come into being along with creation. When that order is not followed, when a person does not follow the dharmic rules that one is meant to follow, then it leads to chaos. And then Lord Brahma explains, then when that happens, I myself through my will manifest in the form of pious people, in the form of great mahatmas, or in the form of avatars themselves, to set right this chaos which has set in because of people not following dharma.
And that is what leads to avatar. And very interesting thing that Brahma is telling Narada, because it makes it clear that the whole creation comes from the will of God. Like they say, not even a blade of grass moves without the will of God. A few days back, you know, after I was playing badminton, one of the college students met me and said, brother, is it true that not even a blade of grass moves without the will of God? I said, yes, that's what it is. That is what it is. Then he says, then all the bad I'm doing is the will of God, so I have got nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, all the bad you do is the will of God. And because of the bad, that things, the effects that you get also, that's also the will of God. If you can accept it that way, then it's fine. We have a problem when the effects come back, you know. I am happy as long as the will of God makes me slap somebody. I'm not happy if the will of God makes somebody else slap me. So, he was, you know, then saying, brother, I'm fully confused. Mm-hmm. Why should God make me do bad then? I mean, if he's willing everything? You know, when I was thinking of this, I felt the answer comes from this, from this description that Brahma gives to Narada. It becomes very clear that the whole creation is definitely the will of God. But God, unlike most of the bad bosses in the world that we have today, is not a micromanager. He doesn't go poking about his nose in every little thing and trying to, you know, this is the way it should be done. Instead, what he has done is he has given a general guidelines and set the rules which we call as dharma. And the ball is set rolling, you know. The ball is set rolling. So, that is the rules by which the game functions. You flout the rules, you'll get it back. You follow the rules, you'll get it back. Everything goes on a kind of autopilot. Yes, in taking another analogy, the Lord is the pilot of the plane. He can fly the plane. But he sets it on autopilot mode because there are things that can be programmed so that it functions in that manner. Only if there is a sudden crisis or something that requires his attention, the pilot shifts out from autopilot and himself takes charge of the aeroplane. That can be considered as the time of the avatar. You know, coming back to the micromanager analogy, the Lord is not a micromanager. That doesn't mean that he cannot be a micromanager. If we look at possibly the head of a big company, yes, he has got different people, different heads, different things and different guidelines. There is a vision of the company. All this is set to guide the company. So he won't go to each little worker and find out what you are doing, what is that. He won't. But that doesn't mean that he can't. If he wishes, he can. In the same way, the Lord, you know, is not a micromanager. The Lord has created everything. Everything is by his will. And he has set rules which we call dharma. But in extraordinary circumstances, he can choose to become a micromanager, where he'll come and teach every little thing to every little person. And those are moments which we celebrate, because that is what leads the Supreme Almighty to come and teach us how we should sing bhajans, how we should chant shloka, how we should do Veda, how we should sit straight, how we should listen, how we should do seva. Oh, so beautiful it is. We are indeed grateful for these exceptional circumstances where the Lord indeed chooses to become a micromanager. But otherwise, though everything is his will, there is this guiding principle and rule called dharma by which the everything, by which the whole creation functions on an almost autopilot.
That's a pleasant way of looking at it. I was thinking of a little more disruptive example.
Okay.
You know, it's like, you know, when you decide what nature should be the new republic which is formed, you know, when India was formed, we decided it should be a socialist or it should be a capitalist or communist. We give it names so that would
secular,
define
yes.
the economic nature of the country. And then from there you write what you call your monetary policies, right? You know, how the RBI has to be governed, how the bank should be related to the RBI and all of this. These monetary policies again can be changed time and again. But it'll still have to be in consonance with the constitution, what you say is going to be the nature of this new republic. But once in a while, even that doesn't work, you can have a demonetization where you have the whole economy shaken up, because it becomes necessary after a long period of time that small measures are not enough. You need a Purnavatar to step in and, you know, shake up the whole thing to take it back to, level zero and start the whole thing again. Again, it will, it is pointed out even in the Bhagavatam, the Lord comes, it does not mean that it all goes back to Satyuga. It comes to a certain amount of equilibrium, but again, things start getting worse and the Lord has to keep coming back again and again. Thanks to that, we have so many avatars of the Lord coming in our midst.
Dear listeners, if you're thinking that Prem and I are sitting here and throwing multiple analogies to, you know, just make it more confusing, that is not the way it is, because there is no analogy that is complete enough to describe why the avatar comes. That is why to describe each facet of what the avatar does, we probably pick different analogies. Yes, the avatar coming is disruptive, as Prem said. Yes, the avatar coming is comforting, as I said. So everything happens. So to describe each facet, we need to pick one analogy, and the analogies can be very diverse. Because if at all I want to think of one comprehensive way of describe why the avatar comes, I think the only analogy that comes is the avatar coming. Nothing else can describe it. That's all it is. That is, therefore, these multiple analogies. But as both Prem and I agree, it leads to these beautiful interactions. It leads to these beautiful kathas. It leads to this beautiful Bhagavatam. And that is what we get to know from this dialogue between Brahma and Narada. After which, you know, Swami in brief covers all the avatars actually. He doesn't go into great detail except for the Varaha avatar, which I think we already described during the previous satsang. In detail, Swami writes about the Varaha avatar, but then he just makes a mention of the Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narasimha, Vamana, Parashurama and Rama, and then tells that the complete Purna avatar is Krishna, and that is what even Parikshit is eagerly looking forward to. In the meanwhile, you know, while narrating this, Shuka makes it a very powerful point. I mean, he makes it a powerful point through the dialogue and conversation between Narada and Brahma, where Brahma tells Narada that all the wrong things that you see happening happen because people forget that the ultimate goal and the inner core of everything is the Lord. When you forget that and start going behind the world, that is when problems begin, which compound, which also finally lead to an avatar coming. But there are those that recognize God as the inner core and the ultimate goal of everything. And like these, innumerable examples abound. And after saying this, I think a lot of examples of such people are also given.
Right. You know, he speaks of, as we were saying, apart from coming as avatars, even he comes as noble souls. He comes in the form of the names that he mentions, like King Sagara. I think we had spoken about him in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, Ikshvaku, and he speaks
the
of...
the progenitor of the race from which Rama...
Right, Rama is born. He talks about...
Rubhu, Dhruva, right. Raghu Maharaj, Yayati, Mandata... I mean, Alarka, yes.
The very fact that some of these names we are not familiar with is, explains the fact which you are referring to, that he comes in so many forms that it is actually impossible to cover the Bhagavatam comprehensively. And who can understand that better than people like us at Radio Sai, that even one avatar's complete life is impossible to cover comprehensively. And what do we talk about? The Lord coming again and again in the form of avatars, taking multiple forms. in different proportions, if you could put it that way. And it's literally impossible. That's why it doesn't matter. You know, comprehension is not a virtue in this regard. That you just need to fill your time with the Lord's name. You don't have to listen to everything about the Lord. You don't need to know everything about Swami. If you have enough about Swami to fill your life till the point when your time is up, I think that is more than enough for Bhagavatam.
And that is what Swami would always emphasize on, quality over quantity. You need not drink a gallon full or a tank full of sugar water, sugar syrup, to know the sweetness of sugar. A teaspoon is enough. If you know how to savor it, I mean, we get that flavor, we get the taste, and we enjoy the sweetness. So too, it is definitely not possible for any of us to cover comprehensively all the stories, all the mahimas, leelas of the Lord. But whatever leela and mahima we cover, we get the same sweetness out of it. That is the beautiful thing that we should keep in mind. And therefore, we have got nothing to lose. We can just move with gay abandon. We can just move through the stories, leaf through them, keep enjoying the sweet rasa that comes. And as you said, sanctify our time, our years and our life with the sweet nectarous story of the Lord.
So I think with that, dear listeners, we'll have to conclude this week. But as we said, there's a new Bhagavatam which is starting from tomorrow, the Satya to Sai Season 2 or Episode 13 onwards, however you wish to call it. We are very excited about it because the stories of Swami are endless and the stories of Swami can give us endless delight and bliss. And we are very, very glad to be able to share that with you. So tune in to that tomorrow. If you look up in our website, I think it should be right there on the homepage.
By tomorrow evening, possibly.
Right, by tomorrow evening. Because tomorrow, as we mentioned in the fly, it's also a very, very important day. The day which means a lot to all of us. The day Swami declared his avatarhood. Tomorrow is the 20th of October.
With that, dear listeners, we come to a close of this satsang. We are grateful to Swami, as always, for this beautiful opportunity to sit officially and discuss about him, think about him. It is such a pleasure, such a joy. We pray that we get the yearning of Parikshit so that one day, whenever our time comes, we too reach our destination at his lotus feet. See you again next week, dear listeners. Hope you enjoyed this as much as we did. You can, as always, write in your feedback to us at listener@radiosai.org. We will be now ending with a song, Swami's bhajan, actually. It's a song or a bhajan because since Swami has sung it, it's a bhajan, but it's actually a song. It's so beautiful. It describes all the avatars of the Lord. It also describes the reason why avatar comes, and all of this in a song form from the avatar himself. Do enjoy this bhajan and or song, whatever you may call it. On the other side of it, you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.